Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that is the National Afghan Dance Music. To introduce our show today, we will be talking with Nadia Tarzi, founder and executive director of the Association for the Protection of Afghan Archaeology. Thank you for being with us. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Susan.
We are going to talk today about this great cultural heritage that Afghanistan is and has that seems to be missing in the conversation that's happening about the war.
Yes, indeed. Very few people know about the archaeological or historical heritage of Afghanistan and its extent. Afghanistan has a historical background that goes back to the Paleolithic times and Bronze Age, and it's a fascinating journey that the people of Afghanistan today have through their ancestry gone through in time. And as some people say, you know, we lost and we lose a lot in Tibet, the same thing is happening drastically in Afghanistan, especially in the past 30 years of war.
Nadia, let's talk about how you came to this topic.
My father is the former director of archaeology and conservation of historical monuments of Afghanistan, and also the former Director General of the Archaeology Institute of Afghanistan. And his journey is quite fantastic. He arrived in France at the age of 19 to study archaeology, to become an archaeologist and serve his country. And if I can just say a parenthesis, you know, why France? Well, in the 1920s, the king then, King Amanullah Khan, wanted to modernize his country and went to France and asked France and its French delegation of archaeology to come and excavate in Afghanistan and at the same time provide training for Afghan nationals. So my father's training is a direct result of this. So I've heard of archaeology all my life, of the archaeology of Afghanistan, but particularly in 1994, I was already living in the United States, and I went back to France where my father lived in exile since he left in 1979 with the Soviet invasion. And he received an envelope that day with pictures. And I remember this moment very clearly because that day, particularly, we were laughing and having a great time. And when he opened the envelope, his demeanor completely changed. He was devastated, and I couldn't understand why, and I wanted to find out, and I insisted to find out. And then he showed me a couple of pictures that, to me, frankly, just looked like heaps of clay, and I couldn't make anything of it. So I persisted in asking questions, and eventually he pulled out a book and showed me pictures of beautiful niches from a Buddhist monastery in Afghanistan that he had excavated, Hada, and then these pictures on the table. And he said, this is before and this is today. And I came to realize that the man in front of me wasn't just my father. He was a person who had devoted his life to unearthing stories and objects that would tell stories about who the people of Afghanistan were and who the people of Afghanistan had met throughout the centuries and with whom they had created incredible works of art. And that his hands were tied and that things were being destroyed and looted and vandalized. Since 1994, I began to learn about Afghan archaeology in greater detail. I've pretty much followed my father's footsteps. I'm far behind because I'm not a scholar. I don't have a PhD, but I definitely have the passion and the sense of urgency to do something about it.
And can you tell one of those stories? Let me tell our listeners that I met you when you were doing a workshop recently called in the Afghanistan Summit, which is an annual thing, and I recommend people find out more about that. But you were doing this workshop, and I knew a little bit about Afghan archaeology. The Buddhas of Bamiyan, of course, have been on the front page, well, were for a while. But that day I learned so much more about just the richness that was there. And I actually mean richness in terms of material wealth also, because that day you spoke about gold coins that had been found. We talked about the Buddhas of Bamiyan. Let's tell a couple of stories for our listeners to understand some of what has been traditionally the crossroads, as we say.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating place. Since the Paleolithic time, there is evidence, now archaeological evidence, of trade in that region. And most people know about Pakistan or the Indus civilization. There was the Helmand civilization in Afghanistan as well. And then it was followed by the Achaemenids or Greater Persia and Alexander the Great, and following Alexander the Great, the Hellenistic period, which is, if you will, the survivors of Alexander that stayed. And then you have the Kushan dynasty that came along. So, and I'm talking about just the bigger ones, but they're sub-civilizations constantly, a brassage of movements of people coming in and out of Afghanistan constantly, that creates a very unique art in Afghanistan. And of course the Mughals and the Islamic invasions and so forth. But what I'm trying to get to is you have thousands of years of constant meeting and constant new artistic creation that comes together and has produced very unique type of artwork. The Bamiyan Buddhas, for example, are a great example of this. They were built in a cliff in the Bamiyan Valley in the 4th century, but Buddhism already traveled in Afghanistan as early as the 1st and 2nd century AD from India. And just a little story about that, the Indian sovereign Kanishka is at the source, in reality, of the first physical representation of Buddha to be made. Buddhism existed in India for centuries before the 1st century AD, but Buddha was never represented as a human being. When Kanishka encountered the Greco-Bactrian, or the people who had stayed after Alexander, when he met those civilizations and saw their artwork, you know, they were making beautiful Greek statues, that he held an emergency meeting, and it's actually registered, it's written about, during which it was decided that Buddha would then be represented as a human being. So the first physical Buddhas are born in Afghanistan. And those Buddhas were a representation of it. You mentioned the coins that I talked about at the Afghan Rebuild Summit. That is, it's a result. The reason I brought this up is because in the past 30 years, Afghanistan's been relentlessly looted. My father always says that never in the world's history has a country has been as relentlessly looted as Afghanistan, because it's on a 24/7 for the past 30 years. And in enormous amounts. I mean, entire sites have disappeared. And the example of Mir Zaka, the monetary treasure I spoke of, is as follow. In the 1940s, Professor Daniel Schlumberger and Ali Khozad, a great Afghan historian, came across a water source in which they found 13,000 gold and silver coins. And those were put on an inventory, and they were published, and everybody was ecstatic to have found that treasure, and everybody thought that was the end of it. But in 1982, in full civil war, a woman went back to that source, found a coin in her water jug, went back to her village, told them about the gold coin, and everybody went crazy because they remembered the 1940s story. During that time, because it was full civil war, there was a militia there, and unfortunately, and they went to the source and hydraulically pumped out 4.5 tons of gold and silver coins and 500 kilograms of silver and gold dishware and objects, right? Why is this important? Well, here's what happened with them hydraulically pumping this out is that they had no intention whatsoever, for example, to have archaeologists on site do the excavation properly and get the historical data out of that, the scientific data. Nor were they planning on giving that treasure to the Kabul Museum. What they were planning on doing, which they did, was to sell the treasure. That the coins themselves represented a time period from the Achaemenid, so Achaemenid, Alexander the Great, post-Alexander the Great, and the Kushan dynasty. So we're talking about close to 700 years worth of coins and objects. In addition to just that drama in itself of losing objects and scientific data, Susan, the other thing that happened is that the treasure was sold to a museum in Japan, the Miho Museum, and then was published under a different identity. It's called now the Second Oxus Treasure. So for Afghanistan here, we're talking about losing objects, losing scientific data, and denial of ownership. And that's something that's constantly happening for Afghanistan with all its objects, pretty much, is that they're being looted, they're gone, they are taken out of their historical context, so we can't tell the story. And on top of that, they don't acknowledge that the objects come from Afghanistan. So that's one of the reasons I work very hard with the association too, because the people of Afghanistan deserve to know where they're from, and these objects, all of them, whether it's the Mirzaka treasure or the Bamiyan caves and Buddhas or other sites in Afghanistan, if they're destroyed, dismantled, sold, you know, how do you connect with your cultural past? Who do you know who you are and what your artistic contribution, your people's artistic contribution is for the world?
Let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Nadia Tarzi, founder and executive director of Association for the Protection of Afghan Archaeology. This is KZSU, Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore. Nadia, something that I heard, and it wasn't really part of the news when the Bamiyan Buddhas were blown up, was that these Buddhas actually had huge masks over their faces with either jewels or glass, and at night there would be light candles behind them, and that this would show, these lights would show down the valley. Mm-hmm. And that just struck me such a amazingly creative way to live in that valley. Can you imagine at night this? So let's talk a bit about the Bamiyan Buddhas and the continuing work of the uncovering the reclining Buddhas too.
Yeah, my father is really the expert on this, but I know a few stories that he's told me. In the case of the giant Buddha, there were two giant statues. One was 38 meter high, and the other one was 55 meter high. And the 55 meter high statue was built representing Buddha during a miracle that he had performed. And there were flames coming out of his shoulders, and the way they did that is by having very thin sheets of gold that would be lifted up by the heat of candles or fires at night, and underneath his feet there was a representation of, there wasn't real water, but it looked like there was water because Buddha had performed a miracle by showing his powers in propulsing fire out of his shoulders and water out of his feet, and vice versa. Mm. Then what they've also had done is put a wooden mask, a gilded wooden mask, on the upper part of the face, because a lot of people say, oh, it was defaced, but it wasn't defaced. There's an area where you can find the hinges, and the eyes had either real ruby or ruby-colored glass in front, and they would light fires in the back of the mask so that it would shine through at night, as you mentioned. Mm. But you also have to imagine that the cliff itself had 2,000 caves, and I'm not talking about, you know, Cro-Magnon caves. I'm talking about extremely detailed, adorned caves carved with balconies and stairs, and you have to imagine fabrics flowing everywhere. In the whole of the valley itself, there's about 20,000 caves that can be found. And it was a very vast monastic city. You know, it had over 7 monasteries. My father is still looking for a 1,000-foot-long reclining Buddha statue. He found a 20-meter-long one. There was a royal city. Theologists, merchants, travelers, traders all went through that area. It was a hustle and bustle, incredible. I mean, there's accounts of caravans of 30,000 camels going through there. It's amazing. Yeah.
I actually heard just recently of people that had gone to Italy for a holiday and came back with some of the artwork from caves in Bamiyan. They're being sold on the open market. You know, you can come back and put it in your house.
Oh, that's terrible.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, no, that's awful. It's devastating. There's a big problem with Afghanistan, and probably other countries too, but there's a lack of education, there's a lack of information, there's starvation and neglect. And so people, you know, the population in Afghanistan pretty much is selling its own self, you know, not knowing it's doing so because it's just trying to survive.
Right,
you know, and a lot of the big international market dealers and Pakistani dealers and others, they're completely aware of it and they completely don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're trying to do is a business and making a lot of money and pay very little to get it. So basically the starving Afghans are paid hardly anything just so they can eat. Meanwhile, you know, what will be left? What will be left when the day arrives, hopefully sooner than later, when there is peace there? I mean, there was such a tremendous opportunity for tourism when my father was the director of archaeology there. It was blossoming. Afghanistan was literally on exploding. You know, it was
this
coming
was before
to life.
The Soviet invasion.
Yes. Yeah. It had the money, the resources to create outdoor museums of sites. It had a museum, the National Museum of Kabul had the best collections of Central Asia. And it was known for that, and it was just a fantastic country. I've spoken to so many people that are a little bit older than I am, who have been to Afghanistan either as hippies or travelers, as diplomats, you name it, you know, teachers, and they all fell in love with it, and they all remember beautiful landscapes and kind people, caring people for their families, who adore family, you know, who value joy and laughter, and it's all gone. So I'm trying desperately to connect the Afghan community and non-Afghan community to the value, the beauty, the extent of the history of Afghanistan, so that these objects have a chance to remain in their context, whether it's historical or scientific context, you know. So there's something for the future generations.
Well, now, just to go back to the Bamiyan Buddhas, for a while I remember reading that there was going to be this huge effort to repair them and to either physically repair them, or at last I heard they were setting up some kind of a construction that would allow some kind of high-tech laser lights or something. Now, I mean, how do you, as an archaeologist, feel about this? We've got a sort of high-tech solution to one tragedy.
As an archaeologist, I think the priority would be to unearth what is real, what's there, and turn it into an outdoor museum. Because you can definitely do that with monasteries. And it would give an idea to people. They would see for themselves how people lived in those days, and I mean, I guess, you know, if it attracts, if the laser shows attract attention, if it's used in as a supplement to an educational campaign on valuing history and educating the population to the importance of cultural heritage and its protection by all means. I don't really favor it because I'm so attached to the true nature of the sites and the objects, and I love to be able to feel, I don't want to say the presence, but almost, you know, the energy that was invested in making those mm-hmm. things. So the laser show, to me personally, would take that away. But again, if it can be used, you know, in conjunction to other efforts.
There are still people living there to some degree in the caves, as I understand it. And then some of them have been sent to different areas to live.
The way it was handled was not correct. What happened is that, yes, there were a lot of refugees that were living in the caves because they had no other place to go. What happened to the caves then was that people were making fires inside of the caves, and the soot of the fire was covering the murals and destroying it. And then there were animals living in the caves. So if you looked at it from a perspective, a selfish perspective, you might say, of a conservator, an archaeologist, a historian, it's not acceptable. I mean, what my father says, for example, is that no other country would allow a historical site to be inhabited by anyone. Why should Afghanistan, you know? And so UNESCO intervened, and they moved the population, and they built houses for them, but they did it in an area that was windy like crazy on a plane, that they have to walk miles for water. It's not, you know, they should have tried to come to a better compromise there. Mm-hmm. So yes, there were people living there. They're no longer living there. There is a guard, a couple of guards, and their families that live, I think, in two caves that are already stripped, if you will, of murals and so forth and so on. And they are guarding the premises from looters and from wanderers. I just want to say, though, Susan, the work my father does in Bamiyan, you know, he's excavating there since 2002. He had an incredible opportunity, a lifetime opportunity in doing so. Since he had fled Afghanistan in 1979 for his life after the Soviet Union, he was in exile in France. And when the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were sort of pushed back temporarily by during the Bush administration by their involvement in Afghanistan after 9/11, the French government offered him to resume excavations. So he's been excavating every summer since 2002, which is incredible. So with his work, he's created a beautiful relationship with the local inhabitants. Not only do they expect him every year wholeheartedly because he hires them as workers, and although they're not paid nearly what normal wages are in the United States or elsewhere, they are able to provide for their whole family for the whole year. But in addition to that, the landowners have become stewards of the ruins. So you have a great osmosis almost. They are aware and educated on what is on their grounds, and they protect it with all their might and with lots of pride. And so there is no looting going on. You know, it's on their land. So that he's very proud of, to have achieved that.
Let's remind our listeners again, Nadia Tarzi talking with us today about the richness of Afghanistan's archaeological heritage. Let's talk a little, Nadia, about the war. We see now we've got 30,000 more troops going. Is it likely that the troops are coming into contact with some of this heritage, and that the fighting is going on in these areas too?
I'm pretty sure. I mean, Bagram, for example, where the American base is, was a very important historical site. The Hidden Treasures exhibit that was here in the United States, that's in Canada now, has on exhibit beautiful treasure from Bagram. So the country is littered with sites that some of them we don't even know yet of. Some of them we do know, we won't talk about them because we don't want anybody else to go there and destroy them. And some unfortunately have been found by illegal excavations. Yes, it's quite possible that the troops come across these kind of treasures. Think I heard also that there's been training provided to them so that they would be aware of the importance of not removing anything from the grounds, or at least getting the Kabul Museum or the Archaeology Institute or the Ministry of Culture informed when they do find something, so that it's not removed. I mean, you should never remove anything, because most likely there's more underneath, and we need to know what the story is. We need to be able to get in there and excavate properly and have an inventory of what's found. So it's really important that the troops contribute in that direction when possible. I mean, they have a lot of other things to worry about. And the population might not be aware, you know, they're not always aware of what the value is. They know it's money value, but historically, you know, what it represents.
Can you talk a little about the history of Bagram, of course, before all of this war, and what kinds of
objects
would be?
So what we know of Bagram was that it exists already during Alexander the Great. And I don't want to be quoted on whether he founded it or not. That I don't know for sure at the moment. But it was the summer capital of the Kushan dynasty. The Kushan dynasty being after Alexander the Great, and being the dynasty that very much propulsed Buddhism in Afghanistan, in creating Buddhist art and monasteries and so forth and so on. And Bagram would have been the summer capital of Kanishka.
It and was summer because it's high up and it's cooler?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And my family too had properties in different areas of the country based on the seasons. Mm. They would move around.
Lebanon is like that also. Yeah.
And as I spoke of trade, Afghanistan was on the Silk Road. On one of the Silk Roads, there's not one road, there's many roads going on towards the same directions, if you will. But even prior to that, during the Bronze Age, we say crossroad of civilizations, because literally that's what happened. If you went from the west to the east or the east to the west, you had to go through Afghanistan. And so you find throughout the centuries very distinct evidence of trade. And Bagram, for example, shows Greek, Roman, Chinese, Indian art, all fusing together. What was interesting with the exhibit was that, for example, there is a professor at UC Berkeley, Sanjot Mehendale. She published an online digital catalog of the Bagram ivories. It's a beautiful work she did. And she's very knowledgeable on that period. And in the chamber where most of these treasures were found, there were some elephant tusks that were already carved and some that were in the process of being carved. So were these ivories coming from India? Were they made in Afghanistan to be, you know, shipped off? The reason I bring this question up is because a lot of people have said, oh, well, then it's not from Afghanistan if it's from India. But the point is here is that there were artistic studios, art centers that took in influences from all over the place and produced them locally. You know, the gold from the Tola Tapa treasure that was also on the exhibit that belonged to nomadic king tribes was with local gold from Afghanistan, yet these were nomads. So it's really interesting to start thinking about these things.
Is there any tradition that is still continuing there under the current circumstances? Are people still able to create, or is things so stressed that
No, I think Afghans are very creative people. What the war has done, though, Susan, is deprive, for example, carpet weavers, people who do embroidery, from obtaining the original natural pigments that they use to color their threads, for example. So a lot of the coloring now is like we would buy our own, you know, like chemical coloring. There's still ceramics. The Taliban definitely forbid any kind of art, music, singing, dancing, and so on. So people are coming out of their shell, if you will, but it's difficult.
Do you think once there's been a turning towards more artificial chemicals, as you say, rather than the vegetable dyes and so forth, people will go back, or will they just stay with what they became used to?
I'm afraid that if someone doesn't tell them that it existed otherwise before, they won't go back because they don't know that there was a place to go back to. You know, there was a brain drain. There was a talent drain. There was a total drain of the country since the Soviet Union. The people that live in Afghanistan now are not the people that lived in Afghanistan before. A lot of them don't know how Afghanistan used to be. So I can't tell for sure, but I have a feeling that the kind of work we do, the idea of telling the story of before, I could spend hours telling you in a lot more details and maybe better the stories of the past, you know, from Begram to Bamiyan to the battles and so forth. And my father is even greater at you just, it's fascinating. There's so much to talk about. It's very important. If somebody knows anything about how these dyes were made, to write a book about it. Mm-hmm. If anybody knows how people were making such and such ceramics, you know, to write a book about it. And why a book? Because once you print a book, you know, it can be reprinted, it's always available, it can, of course, be put on the internet, but it's a resource, you know.
Well, let me remind our listeners, actually, if they go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, we've done several shows on Afghanistan. One of them, interestingly enough, was with, I think her name is Shireen Pasha, who did a movie about a building being built with mud and straw. And it's a very sculptural building. It's very beautiful. So I'm going to direct folks to go to the website and find out more about that. But you also are, as a part of the your work as founder and executive director of the Association for the Protection of Afghan Archaeology, you're doing a lot too. You're going into schools. You've created a book. Let's talk about that. But first, let me tell our listeners that the website is www.apaa.info. What about this book that you are busy working with?
I've been working all through the years at translating my father's work from French to English and organizing events and fundraisers and conferences. And I've had great opportunities to work with UNESCO and the FBI and so on, and to raise awareness and go to schools and work with Mayor Gavin Newsom and the ambassador of Afghanistan, Mr. Sayed Taiz Jawad, and people at the State Department and so forth. So I'm happy and excited that we're pushing the word out, and that's the only thing to do is to do that, is to let constantly toot the horn. And I thought that one really good way would be to do a children's book. And so I am working on Shine a Light on Ancient Afghanistan, a children's book. And we work with local artists and scholars from all over the world. And we're pretty much telling the story of the history of archaeology, of Afghan archaeology, but in a very organized way. And it will be accessible for schools and families, but the idea is that it's graphically appealing and simple enough for younger children to be involved in the conversation, as well as, you know, it's K through 8th. You know, I want it to be broad enough for everyone to be interested in. Mm-hmm. So there are certain, you know, like the chronological tables and so forth are more advanced. There are some areas in the book that are more advanced, we have more information, lots of resources. And then, like I said, the graphics are attractive and simple enough for anyone. Mm.
So it's really a book that children can grow with too, it
yes.
sounds like. Yeah.
Yep.
And can listeners, where in the process is this now? Can listeners get hold of it yet?
Not yet, no. We're hoping that it'll be published in, I was hoping 2010, but it looks more like 2011, although with a little bit of luck, we'll be able to push it for 2010.
So again, www.apaa.info. Nadia Tarzi, I can only imagine what a sense of needing to hurry, needing to get things done, you must carry with you all the time. What is it that you would really like our listeners to know most of all about Afghanistan and what's happening there and what has happened there?
I would love for listeners to understand that there is a vast amount of art that is that belongs to our collective memory. It's not just Afghan art, it belongs to our history, our world history. You know, we have and it's unique, and we all in this time of war and incertitude, I think it's so wonderful that we can have an opportunity to reflect on where we come from and how much history we have behind us and how people have been able to express that through works of art through the centuries. And we owe it to ourselves to be proactive in preserving all cultures, Native American, Indian, French, you know, Iceland, it doesn't matter, but Afghanistan too. And we are on the verge of losing absolutely everything. We've lost 60,000 objects, official 60,000 objects to date that we know of. That doesn't account for the 40, 50, 60, I don't know, 70,000 objects that we've lost that we don't know about, that we can't, that we'll never be able to get back to see or to even make a little claim of ownership on. And I want people to know that what they see on television is not what Afghanistan is about, that the people of Afghanistan are beautiful people, they're kind people, they've had war in their country for way too long, they're all traumatized, they need peace, all the people there want is what we want, is their family, healthy, happy children. Afghans have a great sense of humor, and they love to party. They love to dance and sing and be with their families. That's what they want. So,
and this is one of the things that it seems to be missing in the way our current president, for example, is talking about what needs to happen in Afghanistan. It sounds like if we figure out a way to bring back the or to re-express the joy that seems to be in that culture, who knows what would happen?
Yeah, I think our president, though, with the threat of Pakistan having the nuclear weapon, is very unsettling. If you think about that irrational fundamentalists could take a hold of that, then we would all be in very big trouble. I just don't like war in general, and I don't like the idea that more troops are being, that any troops are being ever put on the line. It's just hard to tell what is right and what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just approach it from a troop standpoint. You have to address the fact that people are hungry, don't have employment, that there is corruption not only in Afghanistan but just from the time funding is allocated to Afghanistan, it's not managed properly in the United States. You know, I mean, not even half of the money that's allocated leaves because it's subcontracted all over the place. So people have to understand that too, and that needs to be managed differently. You know, it's not just that, because people say that there is corruption, there is, but the whole, you know, the whole, there's a lot of work to do for everybody. I think more troops for training,
mm-hmm.
the military and the Afghan police, yes, absolutely, to try and fight insurgency. I don't know, the terrain is just really brutal, you know. How do you, if you look at the cracks and valleys and things, I mean, it's you're at a loss. The Soviet Union fought for over 10 years, and they had the means to do it, and they were shot down by guys who had I'm exaggerating, but who had, like, one-shot hunting guns.
I've heard this before,
you know,
guns from
true.
When the British were there.
And Afghans, you know, they come from, if you think of centuries, right, of invasions. They're warriors. I mean, we are people of of a free land that now today has the borders it has, but didn't have. Pakistan didn't exist before. I mean, and it's a phenomenal country that's never, you know, the British tried to invade Afghanistan, they failed. They had invaded India. It's the whole fighting thing. I'm not sure that that's the way to go. It's training Afghans to protect themselves and organize themselves, yes. Try and provide them with the infrastructure that's needed to restart agriculture, because it was mainly an agricultural land that could support itself and had great fruits and vegetables, by the way. I heard that too. Building schools, education, and training people, giving them the skills they need,
mm-hmm.
you know, and archaeologically speaking, train archaeologists. Lots and lots of well-trained PhD holders, archaeologists, who can then educate the people around them, you know,
mm-hmm.
about the history and the value and the protection, the need to protect.
Yeah, Tarzi, with all of this, I mentioned earlier this couple in Italy that brought a piece of a cave mural back with them and was just able to buy it on the open market. With all of that going on, as you mentioned, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of pieces out there, what about repatriating these pieces eventually when there's more peace in Afghanistan? How do you feel about that?
I definitely feel that the day there is peace in Afghanistan and the Kabul Museum is rebuilt, because that's the wish of the museum director at the moment. There is no alarm system. There is no security at the moment, so they can't house collections that they would like to house, so they can share it with the people of Afghanistan. At the moment, I wouldn't favor this, but one thing that can be done right away is the acknowledgement of ownership of Afghan objects that are in the world, in museums, in private collections, here and there, because that's not happening. One of the things that has happened to the objects throughout the years is that they either have been published under different identities than their own, hidden, of course, from the public eye, or dismantled and put back together into a different object so that they could never be retraced. You know, like I said earlier, we lose the object, we lose scientific data, and we are denied ownership. And
Cultural ownership.
Mm-hmm. Cultural identity.
Right.
The identity of the object. At the Metropolitan Museum, for example, there is a Bodhisattva head from the Hada site that's near Jalalabad in Afghanistan that was excavated in the 60s by my father's predecessor, that has an identity. It actually has an inventory number, and it says on the label, possibly from Afghanistan. Well, in this particular case, what needs to happen, in my opinion, is that possibly be removed. I'm not asking them to return the object, for example, but just do not say possibly, because in this particular case, we can prove that it is definitely from Afghanistan, which we can't always do, unfortunately. And we don't have, the country doesn't have the financial means to go to courts and do the whole process of, you know, like repatriation, ownership, you know, all that. But what can be done right away, when we can prove it, and there are some objects we can, we have the experts, such as my father and others, Paul Bernard, who's excavated Ai Khanoum from 1964 to 1982, he will recognize anything that comes from the Ai Khanoum site. In that sense, I think that would be very helpful.
You talked earlier about the Miho Museum.
Yes.
And it sounds, I mean, the way I was hearing it was there was a reluctance on the part of the museum curators there to acknowledge that this was from Afghanistan. Is that partly because it would potentially require returning some of those items?
Probably. Japan, on the other hand, has acknowledged that they have some murals, and they have acknowledged that they have the marble foot of Zeus that originates from the Ai Khanoum site, And they said, we're not returning it now, but we acknowledge that it's yours.
Mm.
And so, you know, that's all it takes. Mm-hmm. Because then the people of Afghanistan can refer to these objects, to the stories that go with the objects. And they can, maybe, if they can't go to Japan, maybe we should have an online catalog of all the objects.
Is there any such thing at this point?
I heard that there was something in the works. I don't know how far they've gotten with that. And I was going to inquire with UNESCO and find out if it's out, or if, you know, I know my father's been working on different things. He's contributed to the first red list of Afghan antiquities that was co-sponsored by the State Department of the United States and produced by is it ECOM? Yes, I think so. And the purpose of this list is for customs in the United States and other places. It gives them a very general overview of the type of objects that one could expect to see originating from Afghanistan. Unfortunately, for example, there was a legislation that was put on the floor here in the United States that collapsed twice. It was called the Crossroad of Civilization Protection Act. It passed for Iraq and it didn't pass for Afghanistan. And that particular legislation, all it would have done, which was very small in the big picture, but nevertheless an additional first step in the right direction, would have been to put an import restriction on objects suspected to originate from Afghanistan. So that red list would contribute towards that. In this particular case with the list, what really needs to happen is a detailed inventory list of all objects that are represented in these different categories. So Bronze Age, you know, everything we know that we have pictures and so forth and so on about the Bronze Age objects. We should have a list of the Bronze Age objects and the coins and the Buddhist art and the Muslim art and so forth and so on. Because there's no period that's left out. There's looting, completely,
yeah,
vastly all over the place. Rory Stewart, who wrote The Places in Between, went to Afghanistan. He was at a place called Jam. There's a big minaret called the Minaret of Jam that the Italians have helped to restore.
That's in the north, the south, which part?
I think it's central north.
Okay.
I have to, more like north. Nobody has ever, you know, the war, Soviet invasion happened, and there had not been time to excavate the surroundings.
Is it still standing, the minaret?
Yes, it was restored by the Italians after the fall of the Taliban, I think. Because it was leaning like the Tower of Pisa, so the engineers who worked on the Pisa Tower actually went to the Jam minaret and helped it to withstand any sort of collapse. So Rory Stewart went into this that valley probably to see the minaret, and then he saw some people digging on the side of the cliff, and they were digging objects out of the cliff. So who
knows? These are just regular civilians.
Yes, farmers, peasants. Mm-hmm. So who knows? Were they actually excavating the city of Jam?
Mm.
That we will never know anything about. So we remain in the dark as to why this minaret, and the minaret usually accompanies a mosque, and the reason the minaret is there is to call for prayer. So obviously there must have been people there. That's what we're facing. So it's outside of Afghanistan, what can be done? Acknowledgement of ownership and more efforts in that sense, more educational outreach, schools, public events, conferences in and out of the university, you know, getting the academia knowledge translated for the general public and making it available. And inside of Afghanistan, you know, training Afghan archaeologists and archaeology police, you know, inviting collectors to a round table and negotiating with them, honoring their habit of collecting, because people like to collect, and my daughter collects ladybugs and so on. You can't criticize collecting, but you can inform them to the vast damage that it's causing beyond the object, the damage to the cultural identity of an entire nation, the inability to that, for that nation to connect with its roots, you know, have a sense of who they are in the world.
Mm. I want to thank you for being with us. This is Nadia Tazi, founder and executive director of the Association for the Protection of Afghan Archaeology. It's been really great to have you. And listeners can go to www.apaa.info. Is there another way that they can get in touch with you? Is there an email there?
Yes, there is, yeah.
We mentioned the Rebuild Afghanistan Summit in this show, and that's every fall for the last several years in San Rafael, California. If you want to know more about that, go to Afghans for Tomorrow to learn more about the summit and how you can get involved. Or this year's speaker was, one of the people was Norman Solomon. There were others too, and it's well worth it. It's really a networking summit for people that are involved in the Afghanistan issues to get to know one another and to learn more about the region. Again, archaeology, philosophy, religion, all of these sorts of things, art. So the Rebuild Afghan Summit. Also, I mentioned other Raising Sand radio shows that we've done on Afghanistan, particularly the cultural and social aspects, because as we discuss in today's interview, the country has a rich cultural and archaeological heritage that is seldom mentioned in the news of war and destruction. So go to raisingsandradio.org and listen to those shows. I mentioned one show in particular with Shireen Pasha. You'll find that one under the title Afghanistan, A View with Trees, Art, and Culture, with writer Tamim Amsari, author and Sufi Robert Abdul Haidar, and others from a cross-section of the arts expressed in that country. Again, that is on the website raisingsandradio.org. Raising Sand Radio is on the road for the next 3 months, and we'll be bringing you news and views from Southern Africa and the Middle East, and I really urge you to tune in. We'll be bringing the voices of ordinary people as well as experts in their field of AIDS and so forth. So listen in. As usual, all views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guests, and not KZSU or Stanford University. Go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, to listen to other shows and to contact me directly. Susan@raisingsandradio.org. Let's go out with a melody for flute from Turkestan.
Hallelujah.